The recipients of this year's MacArthur Fellowships, the so-called Genius Grants, have been announced. They include jazz saxophonist and composer Steve Coleman, social psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt, and historian Pamela Long. All 21 of them will receive $625,000 over 5 years, no strings attached. And that got us wondering what past MacArthur Fellows have done with their money. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR reports on one 1992 winner, the late poet Amy Clampett, whose MacArthur legacy continues to live on.
Poet Amy Clampett was on vacation when she got the news from her friend, writer Karen Chase.
And she was furious with me because she thought I was teasing her. And by the end of the conversation, she said, I'm going to buy a house in Lenox.
Lenox, Massachusetts, home of Edith Wharton, one of Clampett's favorite writers. Chase helped Clampett find this small, clapboard house.
This was her Olivetti typewriter. And this, on the mantelpiece, is a collection of her beach glass.
The house was the 72-year-old poet's first major purchase, but the next year, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Chase reads from a folder of notes from conversations between Clampett and her husband, Harold Korn.
What's going to happen to the house? I don't want it broken up. Hal said, it's ours. It's ours together. It always will be. I'll keep it that way the rest of my life.
After his wife's death and before his own in 2001, Korn dreamed up a fund to, quote, benefit poetry and the literary arts. Since 2003, the house Amy Clampett bought with her MacArthur Grant money has been used to help rising poets by offering them 6 to 12 month tuition-free residencies. Clampett herself didn't see her first volume of poetry published until she was 63 years old. In a 1987 interview with NPR, Clampett recalled her big break.
The first real publication that counts for anything was in 1978, I think it was August. The New Yorker published a poem of mine. I'd been sending things there for years and years, you understand, but they finally took one.
It caught the eye of poet Mary Jo Salter, who was then a junior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. She reads Beach Glass, one of her favorite Clampett poems from around the same time.
For the ocean, nothing is beneath consideration. The houses of so many mussels and periwinkles have been abandoned here. It's hopeless to know which to salvage. Instead, I keep a lookout for beach glass, amber of Budweiser, chrysoprase of Almaden and Gallo, lapis by way of, no getting around it, I'm afraid, Phillips milk of magnesia.
Salter helped shepherd Clampett's work to editors at the publishing house Alfred A. Knopf, and soon she became a star. Salter thinks Clampett would be delighted that her house is helping to give poets the kind of opportunity that she didn't have when she was coming up.
This was the kind of thing that would have meant something to Amy if she herself had been given 6 months or a year not to worry about earning a living and just having a quiet place to write.
You could feel Amy's presence here all the time.
Sometimes in strange ways, says John Hennessy, who was selected for a Clampett residency in 2007.
You'd take a book off the shelf and a train ticket might fall out. It had been a bookmark. But more importantly, you would find her notes to herself in the books. You would leave your work and go into someone else's and then get rejuvenated and come back to your own.
Hennessy composed a healthy portion of his latest book, Coney Island Pilgrims, in the Clampett House, and he's grateful that her MacArthur Grant money is having a lasting influence, which is not always the case with grants.
There's the story of Anne Sexton getting a Bunting Fellowship at Radcliffe. They're now called the Radcliffe Fellowships, and supposedly she put a pool in. But I think that's that's an exception, right? Most of us live off of grants that, if we get them, they go for food.
This December, the 19th resident of the house Amy Clampett purchased with her MacArthur purse will settle in and get to work, and likely draw on some of the same things that inspired Clampett. Among them, a small box on the mantle filled with the late poet's beach glass collection. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea.
Young adult author Jacqueline Woodson says the first time she really understood poetry was after reading Langston Hughes in elementary school.
Until then, I thought it was some code that older white people used to speak to each other. I didn't know what was going on with the line breaks and the words.
Jacqueline Woodson has made a career out of breaking down that code for young readers. She has written dozens of books and won 3 Newbery Medals and a National Book Award.
Her latest book is called Brown Girl Dreaming. It's a memoir in free verse, and it was just longlisted for the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. Kat Chow of our Code Switch team recently spent a day with Woodson and has his profile.
We're standing at the African American Civil War Memorial in Washington, D.C., and author Jacqueline Woodson points at a large stone wall. It's etched with more than 200,000 names of blacks who fought in the conflict.
I heard about it from my aunt, Ada Woodson, who's a genealogist, and she just has our family history all the way back.
Her finger stops as she comes to the name of her great-great-grandfather.
He was part of the 5th Regiment, United States Colored Infantry, and his name is right there, and this is my first time seeing it, so my mind is kind of blown.
Through her new memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, Woodson connects the history of the nation with her family's. She reads part of the poem dedicated to her great-great-grandfather. It's called It'll Be Scary Sometimes.
William Woodson, the only brown boy in an all-white school. You'll face this in your life someday, my mother will tell us over and over again.
That experience of being the only one echoes throughout Woodson's life. She moved around a lot as her parents struggled to stay together and eventually separated. Woodson and her siblings lived in Ohio and South Carolina before settling in New York City. As children in the 60s and 70s, they endured segregation. And race wasn't the only way they stood out. Another was Woodson's faith, as she told some school kids at a D.C. bookstore.
It was a very strict religion, and you have to go door to door. Who knows the name of it?
Mormon,
close, no. Jehovah's Witness. Yep, I grew up a Jehovah's Witness.
Woodson reads a poem about standing outside her first grade classroom while other students pledged allegiance to the flag.
Every morning I walk out with Gina and Alina, the 2 other witnesses in my class. Sometimes Gina says, maybe we should pray for the kids inside who don't know that God said, no other idols before me, that our God is a jealous God.
Woodson's books confront issues like faith, race, sexual identity, alcoholism, and even sexual abuse. They aren't what kids and teens usually see on shelves. She's trying to push the boundaries of what young readers think about.
I do believe that books can change lives and give people this kind of language that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
That rang true for one student at the reading.
I'm Mia Strickland.
Mia just started the 8th grade. She and her mom and a school librarian came all the way across town to hear Woodson talk. Mia even got to read her favorite poem from the book with the author.
I believe in the city, in the South, the past, and the present.
I believe in black people and white people coming together.
I believe in the nonviolence and power to the people.
I believe in my little brother's pale skin and my own dark brown.
I believe in my sister's brilliance and the 2 easy books I love to read.
Mia is definitely part of the audience that Woodson is trying to reach. But she chafes at the idea that Brown Girl Dreaming is only for brown girls.
Teachers come up to me and say, well, I have no people of color in my class, so, you know, that's why I don't know your work.
She says it's crucial for young people to be introduced to writers, characters, and themes that might be unfamiliar.
And I think that's why it's so important for me to write for this age group, because I think they're so open and so honest and so hungry and so full of ideas. And what you find out is there are a lot of similarities in my childhood and their childhood.
Even though Woodson is opening a window on history for young people, she says she's learning as much from her readers as they are from her. Kat Chow, NPR News.
Writer James Ellroy has been capturing a gritty, film noirish Los Angeles for decades now, with novels like The Black Dahlia and L.A. Confidential. He's just released the first installment in a new L.A. crime quartet, a 700-page epic called Perfidia. It follows many of the same characters from those previous novels, and it focuses around the LA police response to a horrific murder of a Japanese-American family the day before the attack on Pearl Harbor. James Ellroy's life reads like a James Ellroy novel. He was just 10 when his mother was murdered in East Los Angeles, a case that was never solved. Ellroy still lives here in L.A., so he invited us to lunch. James Ellroy, thank you for joining us.
Arun, it's good to be here.
We're at the Pacific Dining Car, a relic of a steakhouse near downtown L.A. It's his favorite restaurant.
I've been here at least 16 trillion times. They've made films about me here. I met my beloved second ex-wife, the novelist Helen Knode, in that booth I'm pointing to. We had our divorce party here, so it's a place with some history.
What do you like about it?
I like steak. I like that it's been here since 1921. I like that it's quiet and comfortable and cool on what bodes as the hottest day of the year.
Are you ready to order?
For me, the crab cakes. And Ellroy?
Brother, how about a chicken Caesar with extra anchovies?
We start out talking about Los Angeles.
My relationship to Los Angeles is entirely autobiographical. I was born two blocks from here in 1948. So my parents hatched me in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era, and my parents were right out of film noir. In my book, My Dark Places, about my mother's murder, I said they were a great-looking, my mother and dad, cheap couple, rather like Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell in Macau. So where else are they going to go? L.A. They were both too good-looking to live. They had to have me. So I survived to tell you the story of L.A. way back when.
There's a deliciousness to the detail in this book. I mean, I find myself wanting to put addresses into Google Maps and look them up. When you're doing the research for the historical detail, like, for instance, looking into the reaction in Los Angeles after the bombing in Pearl Harbor or the Japanese internment, how do you go about that? How do you sit down and figure out how to recreate that world, that Los Angeles of that time?
It's in my blood. I'm a historical novelist at my heart. You know, I'm 66 years old. I realize I don't look it. And I've lived here in L.A. most of my life. It's where I come when women divorce me. One of the first things I noted when putting the notes together for Perfidia was proximity. Here's little Tokyo, the chief Japanese enclave of the era. It adjoins Chinatown. You go a few blocks west, you have the LAPD Central Station and the crime lab on the third floor. You cut back northeast, and there's the LAPD Detective Bureau. You get on the first freeway in LA, the Arroyo Seco, and it's a straight shot north to the scene of the Watanabe murder case. The Japanese family killed the day before Pearl Harbor. It's a hotbed of geopolitical tension, war fever, racial enmity, and flat-out race hate. You can go get your Peking duck and talk anti-Japanese stuff at Uncle Ace Kwan's and cut back on foot two blocks, and you're in the middle of the police rousts in Little Tokyo. So that is what gave this book, this realization of mine, its combustible, it's all localized. This is, in a weird way, both sprawling L.A. and small-town L.A. at the same time.
Halfway through my conversation with novelist James Ellroy, our food arrives, and I ask him what about historical fiction attracts him so much.
I've always been in awe of history, and there's an anecdote that serves to explain it. When I was 8 years old in 1956, the pervasiveness, the imaginative pervasiveness of World War II was staggering to me. I believed that it was still going on. I said something that alerted my mother to this misconception, and she explained to me, "No, Sonny, the war ended in 1945, 3 years before you were born." And I had a very hard time believing it. I've always been more to recent American history, but way, way back during my youth. if a historical epoch, its big characters, its circumstances, its geopolitical stakes, its human infrastructure speaks to me, I know it's time to write a novel about it.
So what was it about the, well, particularly the beginning of the U.S. involvement in World War II and the Japanese internment that caught your imagination?
I wanted to live World War II in the American home front with characters I had already created, missed, frankly, and dearly loved.
Do you feel like these are characters external to you or they're part of you?
They're entirely part of me. The laborious process that I engage of writing by hand with pen on white notebook paper, being computer illiterate, existing outside the digital world, and I've written all 19 of my books in this manner, allows me to sustain concentration, I've come to believe, more deeply, and allows me to live more richly in the text as I compose it.
So you live without a computer, without the internet, all that?
I have an assistant. She has a cell phone. She has a computer. She types my books. And I submit handwritten pages to her. I have a fax machine, too.
What about other media? Are you watching the news, listening to the news?
What do you take in?
What's your media diet?
I have a music room and a classical CD collection and a great stereo system. Aside from that, I will watch the occasional crime TV show at a friend's place. I have no television. I have no VCR. I don't watch the news. I don't listen to the radio or read newspapers. I largely ignore the world today. I live almost completely and very happily within my imagination. I'm like, and God will forgive me for this comparison, Beethoven at his desk with a quill pen and his piano over here that he taps out notes on, although I can't play the piano. I like going back to another time and getting lost in it and living as immediately as I can the lives of a tormented Japanese criminologist who was in the direst of straits, the month of December 1941, Kay Lake, William H. Parker, and Dudley Smith.
James Ellroy, it's been a blast speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Arun, it was a deep-down, dirty, lasciviously L.A. blast.
The novelist James Ellroy. His newest novel, Perfidia, is out now. And by the way, those crab cakes were delicious. It's hard to imagine a living writer more accomplished than Margaret Atwood. Novels, poems, short stories, children's books, essays, and works that defy classification. She's distinguished herself in every possible way. Margaret Atwood is somehow able to write fantastic tales that are deeply literary and infused with a brilliant sense of humor. At 74 years old, her wit is as sharp as ever.
When you're writing fiction, everybody thinks you're secretly writing about real people and things, but if you write an autobiography, they think you're lying, as one does.
Atwood's latest book is a collection of wonderfully weird short stories. When we spoke, I asked her to read part of the title story, Stone Mattress. I'll just set it up. There's an older woman who's gone on a cruise, and she happens by chance to encounter the man who had raped her when she was a young woman.
And he doesn't recognize her.
Yes.
But she recognizes him. The next morning, during the chartered flight north to where the ship is floating on the Beaufort Sea, she considers her choices. She could play Bob like a fish right up to the final moment, then leave him cold with his pants around his ankles. A satisfaction, but a minor one. She could avoid him throughout the trip and leave the equation where it's been for the past 50-some years, unresolved. Or she could kill him.
And she goes for option three.
It's kind of set up in the first sentence of the story where it says, at the outset, she didn't intend to kill anyone. So you think, Well, that was at the outset.
It's interesting about these characters. It's really striking about all of them is how they're in the later part of their lives, but they're really still so deeply affected by what happened in their youth.
And you will be too. Yes, it does seem to be a human characteristic that, in fact, those things, although you may forget about them in your 20s, they are the sublayer upon which your life is based, and they come back.
You know, although not many of us get the chance to address them so intimately or in the case of this character, violently.
You'd be surprised.
You have a character in this book. It's from the first three stories in this collection. They're interconnected. And in the first story, you have an aging writer who has created this fantasy world. And it's kind of B-literature, sort of by her own reckoning, this place called Alfenland. But it becomes more real to her, more important to her over time.
Well, it becomes more real to her and more important to her because it's an escape from her actual life. And talk to any writer on that subject. But she starts her series for pulp magazines back in the early 60s before any of this kind of writing had a cachet. So think of a world without Comic-Con. You know, it didn't exist back then. And people wrote these things for the pulps under different names because you didn't want to have the same writer all the time.
No, I wouldn't want to be in a world without Comic-Con necessarily, but at the same time...
You wouldn't want... Let's examine that. You wouldn't want to be in a world without Comic-Con. That's a pretty firm commitment.
It is. I'll stand by that.
Well, I would not want to be in a world in which people didn't dress up from time to time.
Right.
It would be very boring.
Right. Is there, you know, this character Constance in Alfenland? I just wonder, reading about her in this world that she's created, is it a fear for a writer like yourself who has done so much writing that in a way you become trapped by what you've created?
How old are you?
I'm 44.
Oh, do you feel trapped by anything yet?
I feel trapped by a lot of things.
Are any of them of your own creation?
Well, that's kind of deep.
It is. It's quite deep, isn't it? Yes. Well, that was the question you asked me.
Yeah, I would. But I'm supposed to ask the questions. I'm not supposed to reflect on myself.
There are no rules. In Alfenland, we make up our own rules. Okay, let's put it another way. In Alfenland, Constance has got a couple of other people trapped in there.
Yes.
For instance, she's got her old boyfriend in a barrel in a disused wine facility, and she's got her old rival for that very boyfriend shut up in a stone wall and attacked by bees. So she's acting out, but in a way that doesn't actually harm the real people, or so we believe.
I read that you're working on a book that won't be read for 100 years, intentionally, something that's called the Future Library Project.
Isn't that good? So I was approached by the Norwegian Library of the Future. It's called Future Library. They're building the building, the new library, and in that new library there's going to be a room. And they're growing a forest in Norway, and it will grow for 100 years. This recalls Sleeping Beauty to your mind. And each one of those 100 years, they will invite one writer to write a manuscript. It can be anything. It can be a novel, a poem, nonfiction. And all that can be told about it is its title. So each one of those 100 years, the manuscript will be presented and put into this room in the library in a box, sealed, like a genie in a bottle. And at the end of the 100 years, they will cut enough trees from the forest to make enough paper to print the book of these books, of all of the manuscripts that have been put in the boxes.
So you agree to do this, so obviously there's something about this you find attractive or at least intriguing.
There's a number of very attractive things about it. First of all, I will not have to deal with the critics. Think of that. Second, it is a lot like the message in the bottle metaphor for writing any book. So any book that you write it, and then you publish it. That's the bottle part. And it goes out on the sea of wherever books go. It flows hither and thither, and you don't know who may read it. So this is the same, except that there's a 100-year gap. As the writer, you will never know what people think of it. You will also never know whether they understand it, because the language may have changed in that time. Being a practical person, I did think immediately I will have to get archival paper and non-fade ink, or else they might open the box and find nothing in it.
That's Margaret Atwood. Her new book of short stories is called Stone Mattress. It's out on Tuesday. Margaret, great fun speaking with you. Thank you.
Lovely speaking with you.
English writer Martin Amis is out with his 14th novel, Zone of Interest. It dares to imagine the inner lives of soldiers and prisoners in a Nazi concentration camp. It arrived on UK bookshelves in August and will be available in the US this month. But French and German Amis fans will have to read it in English. His usual publishers will not be publishing this book. Alan Chews thinks, yes, it's difficult, but it's worth the read.
When I picked up Martin Amis's new novel and began reading, it felt as though I'd touched the third rail. The material, love and lust and daily life in a concentration camp, it's that electric. Angelus Golo Thompson, the nephew of Martin Bormann, Hitler's personal secretary, serves as the Nazi High Command's liaison with the IG Farben factory on the grounds of the camp. He's a serious womanizer and keeps up a high level of ironic banter with a few close friends, fellow officers, mostly gallows humor about the horrors of the camp. Much to the dismay of one of his friends, Thompson falls in love with Hannah Dahl, the wife of the alcoholic camp commandant, Paul Dahl. The commandant soon finds evidence of his wife's disloyalty. This sets in motion a plot that puts Thompson and his beloved in dreadful danger and exposes to the naked eye the debauchery, thievery, and criminal incompetence of everyone on the concentration camp staff, from the highest-ranking Nazis to the IG Farben managers and technicians, down to the Jewish Sonderkommandos, the complicit prisoners spared long enough to assist with the murderous work of the camp. Speaking about complicity, we actually come to sympathize with Thompson and Hannah as they delicately thread their way through the intricacies and madness of their situation. No small aesthetic feat on the part of the writer. Trumping both of them is Amis's creation of the character of Shmuel, a longtime survivor of the current group of Sonderkommandos, the saddest men in the history of the world, as he himself describes his ilk. "I used to have the greatest respect for nightmares," we hear him declaim, "for their intelligence and artistry. Now I think nightmares are pathetic. They're quite incapable of coming up with anything even remotely as terrible as what I do all the day." In an afterword, Martin Amis meditates on the irony of writing about the unspeakable. It would be unspeakable to cheer about what he's accomplished in these pages, but I do urge you to read them.
The book is Zone of Interest by Martin Amis. Our reviewer is Alan Chews.